So I'm going to take you just back for a moment to Shtisel, to the show that I spoke, the Israeli TV show that I spoke about last night, and quoted the very powerful quote that everyone carries a cemetery of their loved ones inside them. But immediately in the show, it cuts to, after that scene finishes, it cuts to another scene where we see a woman who, at great risk to her own life, is giving birth. Many of us are familiar with the beloved Mary Oliver poem, The Summer Day, in which she asks the question, doesn't everything die at last and too soon? But it doesn't really tell the entire story of the human condition, because of course every death feels to us too soon. We also know that every moment something new is born. On Kol Nidre, it is our custom to read the names of anyone who has died in the last year from our congregational family. But several years ago, we started a new tradition where we also read the names of babies that were born in the last year. Elie Wiesel, in one of his many, many meaningful quotes, talks about the story of Adam. I spoke about Adam on Rosh Hashanah, Adam, who we know, Adam and Eve, as the first sinners. But Elie Wiesel says about Adam that God gave Adam a secret, and that secret was not how to begin, but how to begin again. And that is something that as human beings we are challenged to do over and over and over again, to pick up and to begin again. In the past year, I've spoken to almost every family in this congregation, and very often they would speak to me about what they had learned in this last year and about some of the silver linings of COVID. And they asked, and we all asked the question, what have we learned this year that we would want to take with us going forward? And so I heard the stories of fathers who had the opportunity, sometimes mothers, but I have to be frank, more often fathers, who found themselves at home during the day with their children, able to take a break from work and to shoot some hoops in the backyard. One of the things that I loved and noticed a lot in my neighborhood was seeing young children outside on their bikes without their parents. Something that for many of us was a common feature of our childhoods, something that we would have never even thought to note. But those of us that have raised children probably any time in the last 20 years knows that sometimes one of the great complaints of raising children under those circumstances was how overscheduled they were. And we might have been more familiar with driving them to their activities in the car than to them having no activities and allowing them to just be in the neighborhood. I saw a lot of people baking challah on Facebook, lots of pictures of beautiful challah. And so we all began to ask ourselves the question, what have we learned from this experience? Frankly, I will tell you, one of the phrases that I heard a lot, and I tended to hear this a lot, we had a lot of calls and Zooms and sessions where the Rabbinical Assembly, my membership organization, provided all kinds of opportunities for rabbis to get together to talk to some of their challenges. And one of the things that we talked about a lot was the term self-care. And frankly, I have to say, 18 months or more into COVID, I'm actually really sick of that term. I am really sick of the term self-care. Pretty good at working out, pretty good at getting outside and getting some fresh air every day. But I started to feel that the term self-care is not a very Jewish term, because what we actually believe in Judaism is the idea of communal care. And so while I tended to be pretty good at asking myself the question, what did I need physically? What type of self-care did I need physically? I began to realize pretty early on during COVID, with the isolation that was incredibly difficult for me. I have many friends, well, I have a few friends that are introverts. Most of my friends are extroverts. I have a few friends that are introverts. My daughter-in-law is an introvert, and my son said to me at one point, I'm not sure with the shelter in place that she's actually noticed anything different. And I saw early on in Facebook a post that said, dear introvert, call an extrovert. Put down your book and call an extrovert. They're not okay. So for me, that was perhaps the biggest challenge, doing things by myself and learning. I mean, I did have Dan, and we went for a walk probably almost every day during COVID. But doing those kinds of things came easy for me. Trying to figure out how to care for a much greater need that I had, which was the need to connect with other people, was much, much more challenging. One of my colleagues, my beloved colleague, Rabbi Naomi Levy, wrote a book called Einstein and the Rabbi. And in it, she challenged that each of us ask the question, what does your soul need? And I realized, as I said early on during the pandemic, that I had a very hard time answering that question. How was I to fill my soul during such a time of isolation? And I realized that I could not take care of my soul needs on my own, that they could only be taken care of by being part of a community. And so ultimately, what I had to begin to reframe for myself was not how I could take care of my soul, but how did we take care of each other's souls in this past year, and of course, moving forward. And so when I really look back, and I was on a call not that long ago with the Rabbinical Assembly, and so the question was, what inspired you over this past year? From where did you draw your inspiration? And I hadn't really thought about it that deeply, but the answer came really just bubbling up, which was, what really inspired me during this past year and a half was you, was all of you. And so I want to share just a few stories that really serve as more of examples for what I mean by saying my soul was cared for by you. One of the greatest inspirations in this past year, and perhaps the thing that I am the most proud of, is how really our entire staff kept the congregation going mostly on Zoom. The number of programs that were offered, from something as simple as comedy to cooking classes to Torah study to current events, so many congregants who said, you know what, I'd like to teach something. People that stepped forward and volunteered so that we could have a robust communal life during COVID. But then came what I think was our greatest moment of our congregation, and that was our team of vaccine angels, led by the Israeli family. I heard from one of our congregants in those days, it's hard to imagine now, Alana, it's not just 2019 that's hard to imagine, it's hard to imagine February and March in this country. For those of us that could not wait to get vaccinated, that did not know exactly how that was going to happen, I don't want to admit how many hours I spent in front of my computer refreshing until I found an appointment. But you had to be somewhat computer savvy to grab those appointments, even when you became eligible. And we knew that there were people, some of whom were seniors, not all of whom were seniors, that did not know how to work the technology or even know where to begin to go to be able to find a vaccine. And that's where our vaccine angels stepped in, Hopefully, if you didn't use them, it's because you figured it out on your own. Now we, of course, can't give the vaccines away. But we had a team of angels that stepped in, and anybody that didn't know how to get an appointment and needed help, we put them in touch with this team. Young people, people in their 20s, it was a brother and a sister and two of their friends, and literally within 24 hours would find an appointment for people. And the gratitude that our congregants that needed this help expressed. In Judaism, we talk about pikuach nefesh, the saving of life is the highest value. And I got to sit back and watch that offered to our congregants in need. And I felt that there was no greater experience that we ever had as a congregation than doing that. And many, many people asked me that got the help, how can we thank these vaccine angels? We did send them a gift certificate on behalf of the congregation. But when we asked them, how would, you know, people want to know how to thank you, these four young people said, you know how you can thank us? Make a donation to our synagogue. Not to Am Yisrael. They weren't members of Am Yisrael. They each had their own synagogues. They weren't even members of our congregation. They were just committed to helping. But when they asked how they could be thanked, they said, make a donation to our congregations. If you want to have some faith in young people, have faith in young people that devote hours and hours and hours of their time to helping other people, and the way that they want to be thanked is to support the synagogue that they grew up in. But that was perhaps the most dramatic example of what inspired me this past year. It was really also some of the very simple things that sometimes maybe we take for granted. I had very few, but some opportunities to, I was never at a Brit Milah, I was never at a ritual circumcision during COVID. Those tended to be very small and very private, and so those were not ever really open. But once we were vaccinated, I got to begin to do baby namings. We just didn't have any boys born in that at that time. And I really had to say, I kind of stood back in awe of these families, some of whom already had children at home. So picture this, a young couple, two toddlers, everybody home during COVID, saying to themselves, yeah, I'd like to have another kid. And then they did. And so I got to do my first baby naming for a new family, a relatively new family in our congregation, in just such a situation, having two young children at home, decided to have a third child, and I got to go with the family and to give this baby, to bestow upon her Hebrew name. And the family was very grateful. They kept thanking me for coming, and I tried to really express to them, no, thank you. Thank you not only for bringing this new life into the world and into the congregation, but thank you for allowing me the privilege of celebrating this with you in such a profoundly beautiful and meaningful way. Both sets of grandparents were able to be there from out of town. And for me to see this family that had not been together in over a year at this point, grandparents who had not been allowed to be in the same place with their grandchildren because it wasn't safe, joining together to celebrate new life is an incredible privilege to be able to be a rabbi and to be nourished by that kind of an experience. And then there were the weddings, small, in somebody's backyard. The cantor and I co-officiated at a wedding by Zoom. Both sides of they chose an equidistant location to both sides of the family. Everybody quarantined for 2 weeks. They came together in an Airbnb, so the family was together, the immediate family was together for the entire weekend, and the cantor and I got to join in by Zoom and to officiate at this wedding. You may have noticed that there's a pattern to Jewish weddings. Many, many of them occur in August. How many people have that are married have an August? Anybody else with an August anniversary? So why is August popular? August is popular because for 3 weeks in the Jewish calendar, you can't get married. 3 summer weeks, you can't get married. From the time of Tisha B'Av, the 9th of Av, which commemorates, it's a day of mourning, it commemorates the destruction of both temples in Jerusalem. You have a 3-week time period of mourning and sadness leading up to Tisha B'Av, and weddings are not allowed to take place. So many Jewish couples, as soon as those 3 weeks are over, it's wedding season. And so there's always a juxtaposition, but none that I noticed as much as this year. There is always a juxtaposition because you have the 3 weeks of mourning, and then in our calendar you have 7 weeks between Tisha B'Av and Rosh Hashanah, where you read about the promise that the children of Israel will be returned to their land, the promise that joy will once again be part of our life, that there it's a time of renewal, it's a time of joy. And so to insert weddings already into that framework, I had never noticed it as much as I had noticed it this year. So, Alexa, Alexa Horowitz, one of our Child of Congregant, dear, dear friend, she and I had a standing joke for many years about whether I would be able to fit her into my High Holiday sermon. So this year, I want to fit her in a big way. She, several years ago, made Aliyah, served in the Israeli army, and met her Bashert in Israel, Ethan, another young man from the United States who also made Aliyah and served in the army. And so this was not just a couple getting married, but this was a couple, two young people who love Israel, who committed themselves to Israel. And I was supposed to co-officiate at this wedding. And so all of June, we anxiously watched whether Israel was going to open to tourists. And unfortunately, the sad story was it did not. So I was not able to be under the chuppah with the family, which was one of my COVID losses that I accumulated in this last year and a half. But I got to at least watch it on Zoom. And I have to say, I started crying. You know, everybody cries at weddings. Like, you just see the bride and the groom and you start crying. But I actually cried before I saw the bride and groom, because the first shot that you could see on Zoom was the chuppah, and under the chuppah was an Israeli flag that was part of their chuppah. One of the pieces of the liturgy for the wedding ceremony, for the Jewish wedding ceremony, is something that I used to think of as a statement, but as I've gotten older, I actually see that it's really a prayer. And we say in the wedding ceremony, may there always be heard in the streets of Jerusalem and the cities of Judah the sounds of singing and rejoicing, the sounds of young people feasting, the sounds of bride and groom joined together under the marital canopy. And we know that there have been many times in the past year and a half, and even, of course, before that, that the sounds of joy and gladness, of laughter and singing and feasting and rejoicing, was not something that was heard in Judah or in Jerusalem. And so watching this couple feasting and singing and rejoicing with their family reminded me on a deep visceral level something that I felt that I needed, which was being reminded how much I love Israel. Now, in May, I was reminded of how much I loved Israel, but in a very negative way. Watching thousands and thousands of rockets fired on Israel, and painful in addition to that, watching the media coverage, watching what was happening on social media, watching the outpouring of hatred towards Israel. And so I think my soul needed this wedding to remind me not just the love that I have for Israel when things are bad and when people are suffering, but the reminder of the joy and the fulfillment that Israel can bring to me in spite of its political flaws, which are many. Nachman Shai, Israel's new Minister of Diaspora Affairs and a real friend to the Reform and Conservative movements, wrote a piece that he sent out right before Rosh Hashanah. And he said, "The last year highlighted just how intertwined we are as a people when Israel's summer military operation in Gaza led not only to a frightening rise in anti-Semitism, but significant stress and frustration within communities. It is becoming increasingly imperative for us to work together to ensure ongoing safety, security, and communal cohesion. We still have the ability to bring out the best in each other. Israel needs your daily clarity and backbone to empower us to make the bold decisions that will ensure our continuity as both a Jewish and democratic state. We need your justice-minded values." He's speaking to American Jews. "We need just the tone. We need your," is a very nice change of tone in the leadership in Israel. "We need your justice-minded values to assure Israelis that moving towards two states for two peoples is the only solution, both for your security and our soul. We have room to be inspired by your models of pluralism and diversity and of organized Jewish communal life within our own religious practice. On the other end, Israel continues to be the proud manifestation of the Jewish people's 2,000-year-old dream. Israel, the state, the land, and its people, with all of its complexities, deserves to remain a central component of Jewish identity building and experiences around the world. Finally, you and I," he writes, "have a mutual mission to elevate not only our own people, but the entire world through development of shared projects on climate change, as well as biomedical and technological innovation." But I will say, and all of the examples that I've shared with you were things that fed my soul, that inspired me, and that nourished me during these isolating months. But the very most inspirational thing that I experienced this past year were our B'nai Mitzvah. We could not be more proud of our young people in this past year and a half. We watched them step up in such a big way. 12-year-olds preparing, 13-year-olds taking this ritual upon their shoulders. None of them had the bar or bat mitzvah that they expected when they had gotten their date 3 years before. So many of their closest relatives were unable to attend in person. No party, no friends. I have to say, and this is definitely on my list of Ashamnu, all of the many years congregants said to me, "We have out-of-town grandparents, we have sick relatives, they can't attend the service. Is there any way for them to be able to watch the service?" And I would say, well, you could set up your tablet on your seat and like maybe they could see the service that way. We now, of course, have the technology in the sanctuary to both live stream and Zoom the services so that we will never have to tell a family that even when COVID is open and the door over and the doors open up, "I'm sorry, you have no way for your out-of-town family that can't attend to be able to be present through technology." Some of our families came to the sanctuary with 20 people. And many of our families decided to have their bar and bat mitzvah by Zoom. I watched these young children, these young people, and I thought about how throughout Jewish history, so many generations did not get the bar mitzvah that they thought they would get. None of them got the bat mitzvah. How Jews celebrated through so many difficult times before, whether it was in a ghetto or during the Inquisition or because their family had no money. We were told stories of young men who they would go to a synagogue on a Monday morning when there was Torah reading. They'd have an aliyah. They'd have a little herring. They'd have a little wine. That was their bar mitzvah. And I saw these young people step up and know that they too will have a story to tell. They will have a story that how they had a bar mitzvah during a pandemic. We made the decision pretty early on that for families that decided to have a bar mitzvah by Zoom at home, that we would send a Torah to their home. It came with a long list of instructions about how to treat this Torah. It was a little scary letting our Torahs out of the building. But the feeling was that we wanted them to experience that their home was sanctified by having a Torah presence. And so we saw these young people conduct themselves with enthusiasm, with dignity, and with joy. And we understood that when all the extras were stripped away, the color themes, the balloons, the goodie bags, the DJ, all fun and all things which I miss desperately, but when it was all stripped away, what was a bar mitzvah? You take a 13-year-old, you put a tallit on, you hand them a yad, you prepare them and you put them in front of a Torah, and not one of them said, "This, I'm disappointed." Each one of them was so proud of what they accomplished, and they make all of us so very proud. Perhaps the most meaningful thing I heard during this entire 18 months was a bar mitzvah that was held in the sanctuary about a year ago. Young man, 20 people, and at the end of his Devar Torah, he turned to his parents and he said to them, "Thank you for not letting COVID take my bar mitzvah away from me." At every bris, we have something that's called a kisei shel Eliyahu, Elijah's chair. The baby is symbolically placed in Elijah's chair. We call on the presence of the prophet Elijah before we begin the ceremony. But many of you probably don't know why we have the kisei shel Eliyahu. One reason that's given is that Elijah will herald in the messianic era. So with every baby that's born, every Jewish parent could think, this boy could be the Messiah. With every child that's born, this child could be the one to usher in the messianic era. But there's another reason that's given. Elijah the prophet was incredibly critical of the Israelites of his day. He had no faith in them. He had no faith that they would continue being Jewish, and he was very, very harsh in his prophecy towards them. And so the ancient rabbi said, at every Brit Milah, we are going to call on Elijah to come witness, and this could be equally true, at every Seder table, we are calling in Elijah to show him that he was actually wrong in his prediction about the Jewish people. That the Jewish people, through good times and through more bad sometimes than good, would keep their faith. Isaac Beshevis Singer said, in our home, he was the Yiddish, famous Nobel Prize winning Yiddish writer. In our home and in many other homes, the eternal questions were more actual than the latest news in the Yiddish newspaper. In spite of all the disenchantments and all my skepticism, I believe that the nations can learn much from those Jews. Their way of thinking, their way of bringing up children, their finding happiness where others see nothing but misery and humiliation. This year and a half, more than it's taught me to have faith in the Jewish tradition, it's taught me to have faith in Jews. It's taught me to have faith in you. You have inspired me. You have humbled me. We're here to support each other. Am Yisrael Chai.